actually funny. If we had Zoom, it would have worked out better. 3 years ago, we tried, like, GChat and then, like, Skype, and then we ended up, like, trying to FaceTime. That didn't work. We just, like, had him on speakerphone. It was awesome, though, and the girls loved it. Last year, he actually came to school. He spoke to the 11th, 12th grade boys and the girls. It was amazing. So this year, we can't have him physically in class, at least not yet, but hopefully we'll get him back soon, and this is by far the next best thing. We're super excited to have him, and I don't want to take any more time. And Rabbi Leibowitz agreed to talk about Kiddushin and Nisuin. We had just finished learning Machlokas, Rambam, and Rush, whether there's a mitzvah to get married or not, a bunch of different nafkaminas. And we had many questions about what actually happens at a wedding, what goes down under the chuppah, everything going on, what's a halacha, what's a minog. Rabbi Leibowitz is going to discuss that for a while, and maybe even have time for questions at the end also. So without further ado.
Okay, thank you so much, Rabbi Stromer. I just ask that if I go over time, just make sure to cut me off. I don't know, I don't remember exactly how long we agreed to do this for, but there's a lot to say about a wedding, so just let me know when my time is up. First of all of you should recognize how fortunate you are to have such a wonderful Rebbe like Rabbi Stromer, who cares so deeply about his students and is so incredibly knowledgeable and has the sole goal of inspiring his students to a greater love of Torah and a sense of Yiras Shamayim, and you should not take that for granted. He's a really, really wonderful role model. And I thank you for coming and learning together. I think it's so important to understand what goes on at a wedding. I can't tell you how many times I've been at weddings where the people who really need to know what's going on, the people who are getting married, the chasen and the kala, very often have no idea what it's all about. They have no idea what the different rituals are all about. They don't know what's important and what's not important. So it's such a good idea to discuss that a little bit. Next time you're at a wedding, you'll look and you'll say, oh, I know what that's about. I know that that's not really that important. That is very important. You'll be able to identify the different parts of the wedding. I guess the best place to start would be to discuss the day of the wedding, even before the wedding starts, unless Rabbi Stromer tells me, no, we shouldn't start there. I'm waiting for I don't see any thumbs down. So, okay, so we'll start with the day of the wedding before a thumbs up. Okay, we'll start with the day of the wedding before the wedding. There is a practice that's recorded in Shulchan Aruch. So this is a real practice. It is a minhag. It is not a halacha, but it is a real minhag, quoted in Shulchan Aruch, quoted by the Rama, that the chasen and the kala should fast on their wedding day. Not only do they fast on their wedding day, at the mincha of their wedding day, they say the same Shmona Esrei that one would normally recite on Erev Yom Kippur with the whole long vidui at the end. In Sephardic communities, neither of those practices are very common, but it is very common in Ashkenazi communities. Because it's only a minhag, if there's a good reason not to fast, such as it's a day that you're not allowed to fast, or that it's inappropriate to fast, like it's Tu B'Shvat, or it's Rosh Chodesh, or it's Tu Ba'av, or it's Chanukah, then the couple would not fast, or it's Purim or Isru Chag, then a couple certainly would not fast. But on a typical day, the couple should fast. Obviously, if someone's going to get sick, if someone is going to be ill from fasting, then they would not fast. But the default position is that they do fast, and the basic reason, there are a few reasons given for the minhag. The basic reason given usually is that we assume that on a wedding day, it's like a mini Yom Kippur for a chasen and kala, that they receive Mechila, they receive forgiveness for all of their averos. The Torah itself tells us that Esav married a woman named Machlas, and Chazal tell us, Rashi quotes in Chumash, her name wasn't really Machlas. The word Machlas means Mechila, that she received forgiveness for all of her sins because she got married that day. So you see from there that when you get married, you get forgiven for all of your sins, and therefore, on the wedding day, we treat it like a little bit of a mini Yom Kippur. Others suggest that, no, the reason that we fast is because, in general, you're not supposed to eat before you do any major mitzvah that you have coming up that day, right? You don't eat before you blow shofar, you don't eat before davening, you don't eat before you do any major mitzvah that's coming up, and there's a mitzvah, potentially, which you learned about, maybe yes, maybe no, a mitzvah to get married, and if there is a mitzvah to get married, so you don't want to eat before performing that mitzvah. Others suggest that maybe it's based on the fact that a day of a chuppah is similar to Matan Torah. It's like the day the Jewish people got the Torah. And on the day the Jewish people got the Torah, the Bnei Yisrael fasted. So the Chasan and Kala, it's a day of Kabbalah Satorah. In fact, there's a lot that we do at the chuppah that may be a reflection of the idea that it's Matan Torah, that it's a day of receiving the Torah at the chuppah. Others suggest that maybe the reason the Chasan and Kala fast is because, you know, they're kind of nervous on their wedding day, and maybe if they didn't have to fast, they might imbibe certain beverages that would calm their nerves, and those beverages would lead to a sense of drunkenness. And when one is drunk, they're in no state to get married. So maybe this is all just to protect them from making a poor decision in terms of what they're going to consume on their wedding day. But bottom line is, there is such a minhag, and that's a pretty widespread practice. Again, if someone is going to get sick, then we wouldn't observe that practice. There is also a practice that the Chasan and Kala typically don't see each other before their wedding. That's not really a minhag. It's certainly not a halacha, and it's not even really a minhag. It's just something that people do. People like to generate a certain amount of excitement, you know, when they see each other for the first time in a little while. It creates a certain type of energy in the room, so some people are interested in that, in creating that kind of energy, and that's why they don't see each other for, let's say, a week before the wedding. Others don't do it because, again, people get very nervous sometimes before their wedding, and when people are nervous, they're not themselves, and they say things that they don't mean to say, they do things that they don't mean to do, and you could end up ruining what could have otherwise been a very nice time in their lives by having it laced with anxiety because of things that people should not have said. But it's not really a halacha, it's not really a minhag. For many chassanim and kalas, it's actually healthier that they do see each other. I once had a chassan who had was a Talmud of mine who was very, very nervous about a lot of things, and it was not easy for him to even like make a commitment to get married. He said, but you know, whenever I'm with her, it just feels so right. I know that she's the one for me, but as soon as we're not together, I start questioning everything. As soon as for them not to be together for the week before the wedding, that would have been an absolute disaster. So since this is not a halacha, and it's not even a minhag, I thought that there's no question that they should see each other the week before their wedding. Then there's another practice on the day of the wedding, and you can tell me to slow down if I'm going too fast, tell me to speed up if I'm going too slow. There's another practice on the day of the wedding, and that is a practice of having shomrim, of having guards, so to speak, people to watch over the chasen and the kala. Really, 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 this is a real minhag. It's quoted in the Ramah in Shulchan Aruch. But what it really relates to is during the week of Sheva Brachos, that probably because the Chasan and the Kala are considered to be very respectable people, they're like royalty during the week of Sheva Brachos. So during the week of Sheva Brachos, they should not be going outside alone. They should not be going out on their own, because royalty always travels with an entourage. You know, when the president comes to town, there's a motorcade that always accompanies him. I apologize if you hear the background noise of the gardeners outside. I can't schedule when they come. I hope that's not distracting. But royalty always comes with an entourage, so you don't want Chasan and Kala to have to walk outside alone. So whenever they go anywhere, they should always go with other people. And we've extended that to the day of the wedding also. That throughout the day of the wedding, they shouldn't go out alone, and usually there's a good friend that's appointed to be the one to hang out with them a little bit before the wedding, keep them calm, you know, relax them. You know, the least calm people on the day of the wedding are the families of the Chasan and Kala. So it's probably a good idea, very often, to take the Chasan and Kala, like, away from their families a little bit. Just, you know, have them hang out with a friend, relax, have a little bit more of a looser and good time, and not deal with the anxieties that undoubtedly their families and their parents are going through. You know, it's important for people to remember that even the nicest and best and finest people tend to be completely out of their their minds when they're marrying off their children. So if any of you have siblings that got married, maybe you can relate to this, that people have a lot of nerves when they're, you know, they get very anxious when they're marrying off the children. So it's probably a good idea anyway for a chasan and kala on the day of their wedding to have someone else to watch over them, so to speak. But really the halacha is during the week of the Sheva Brachos that they shouldn't go out alone. I remember I asked, when I got married, I asked my great Rebbe Rav Shechter Shlita, Rav Herschel Shechter Shlita, whether I should attend Shachris Minyan every day during Sheva Brachos. Mincha Marav was not an issue because at the Sheva Brachos itself, we usually daven Mincha right before the Sheva Brachos and Marav right after. But Shachris, I wanted to know, should I be going to Shul? And he said, well, only if someone's going to pick you up and bring you there. I mean, you can't go out alone during the week of Sheva Brachos. He thought it was about going out alone, that leaving my wife in the apartment, we didn't need to call someone to the apartment to keep her company while I went to daven, but that it's all about going out alone, that one should not go out alone. Neither the chasan nor the kala should go out alone during the week of Sheva Brachos. Okay, so that's the day of the wedding. Now we show up to the actual wedding. Typically what happens is the kala sits in like this throne-like chair, and this is an old minhag. It goes back to the days of the Tanoim at least. There's a Mishnah Maseches Kelim that talks about the tumah status of such a chair. There's like this throne that a kala sits on, and she greets her guests while sitting on her throne. And then the chasan is in a room, and he's flanked by his father and father-in-law-to-be on each side of him. And usually there are some rabbis there and some friends that are singing. But really what happens at the chasan's tish is the kala is just greeting guests. Everyone's saying, Mazel Tov, you look so beautiful, thank you so much, you should have a nata, whatever. They give nice brachos and stuff, and that's beautiful. What's happening at the chasan's tish is there's some important paperwork that needs to be filled out at the chasan's tish. A ksuba needs to be signed, a tanoim needs to be signed. So let's describe a little bit of that. But before we get to the paperwork, there is a minhag, it's a practice, it's a minhag that the chasan gives a dvar Torah at the chasan's tish. Some suggest that this also relates to the idea of modeling Matan Torah, that the whole wedding is supposed to be an example of Kabbalah Satorah. So just like Hashem gave us the Torah through Moshe Rabbeinu, so the chasan should be the one, should give over Torah to the crowd that is assembled. There are some that have the practice that do not allow the chasan to speak, that as soon as the chasan starts speaking, they start singing in order to stop him from speaking. That's probably based on the concept that we don't want to embarrass somebody who's not as capable as others, meaning some chasanim are real wonderful b'nei Torah and can speak about Torah and have no problem, others probably not. So we don't want to embarrass those who can't. So as soon as the chasan starts to try, there is a pretty widespread practice to start singing him down. Rav Soloveitchik, Zichron Levracha, was against that practice. He thought that the chasan should speak, that it's totally appropriate for the chasan to speak. My great Rebbe Rav Shechter Shlita often explains that the greatest way one can express joy is by teaching Torah to other people. That's why there's a din that an avel is not allowed to get an aliyah. Right, an avel doesn't have to leave the room by Kriyas HaTorah. He's allowed to be yotzei the mitzvah of Kriyas HaTorah. He can learn the Torah in that context, but he's not allowed to get an aliyah because an aliyah represents teaching the Torah to other people. And yet, who does get an aliyah? Who's obligated to get an aliyah? A chasan gets an aliyah. A bal bris gets an aliyah. Someone who's experiencing a simcha gets an aliyah, and through that aliyah, they teach Torah to other people. I remember when I was in 10th grade, my Rebbe, Rabbi Yisrael Kamenetsky, was and his wife, Rabbi Tzinel Sheva Kamenetsky, were blessed with their first child, Binyamin Kamenetsky, who Rabbi Stromer knows very well. So they had gone a few years, they had been married for a few years and had not yet had children, and this was their first child that was born, and it was a tremendous simcha. They were so, so excited. And at the bris, which was on a weekday morning, And you know, a bris on a weekday morning, everyone's in a little bit of a rush, and everyone, you know, sort of needs to get to work. Rabbi Kamenetsky got up and spoke, and he just like completely lost himself. He just gave like this shiur that lasted like an hour. He just like went on and on and on. Beautiful divrei Torah, and then the final concluding words of his shiur were, "And with that, I would like to introduce Rav Herschel Schechter to speak as well." And everyone's like, "Oh my God! Like this is gonna, like it's already been so long." So Rav Schechter got up to speak, and Rav Schechter said, "You know that a Baal Bris gets an aliyah. When someone makes a bris, they get an aliyah because the way to express simcha is by sharing Torah with other people. Most people are not capable of giving a shir, of actually sharing Torah in that way, and therefore they just get an aliyah to the Torah, which they can handle. But you're so lucky as a community," he told the Tina community at the time, "you're so lucky that you have such a young Talmud Chacham in your midst who's able to share Torah in that way, and through that fulfill this great mitzvah of Simcha." So Mazel Tov. And that was it. That's all Rav Schechter said. And that was the way he expressed this very idea. That's where it comes from, probably, that a Chassan, that a chassan is going to teaches some Torah at the chassan's tish. Okay, but now let's get to the paperwork. The paperwork at the chassan's tish involves two things. There's a tana'im and there's a ksuba. The tana'im used to mean a lot more than it does now. It used to be that the tana'im was not signed at the wedding. It was signed a year before the wedding, and it included all of the financial agreements between the chassan's family and the kala's family. You're going to pay for this, you'll pay for that, we'll take care of this, we'll take care of that. And all of the financial agreements, and it was signed in advance, and it was and it was a commitment to go through with the wedding, that if either side backs out, there were severe financial penalties for backing out. It was like this serious agreement. Nowadays, by the time we do the tanaim, it's at the wedding anyway, and everything's already been agreed upon far in advance. Everything's been paid for already by the time they do the tanaim. So noticing that issue, Rav Moshe Feinstein, Zichron Levracha, whose great son, Hagon Rav David Feinstein, just passed away this past week, Rav Moshe Feinstein, Zichron Levracha, rewrote the tanaim. He rewrote it because it didn't make sense to have the old tanaim with all these penalties and financial agreements. Everything's already been taken care of anyway. So in Rav Moshe Feinstein's version of the tanaim, all the document says is that it's an agreement between the father of the chassan and the father of the kala that says that we have taken care of everything and we're ready to bring our children to the chuppah. And that's it. It's an agreement between the two fathers that they're ready to bring their children to the chuppah, and they have no tainas on each other, no claims against each other. Everything is worked out. And that's why you'll notice, if you ever see at a chassan's tish, before they sign the tanaim, they'll have the father of the chassan pick up a pen or a handkerchief or something, or a yarmulke. I've seen some Masada Kedushins will take their yarmulke from under their head and they'll pick up the yarmulke, and the father of the kala will do the same, because it's not an agreement with the chassan and the kala. It's an agreement between the father of the chassan and the father of the kala. Chassan doesn't need to be there. The kala doesn't need to be there. It's just an agreement between their fathers to bring the children to the wedding, and that's and the picking up the pen represents an act of a kinyan to show that they're really seriously committed to this agreement. So they're each committing fully, and then two witnesses sign on the document. Whenever we have witnesses at a Jewish wedding, it always has to be the witnesses need to have certain qualifications. They need to be male, over the age of 13, not be related to each other, not be related to the chassan and the kala, and they have to be Torah observant. They cannot be ganavim. They can't be people who steal money from other people. They can't be. They should not be gamblers or degenerate gamblers. At least they have to be. But they do not need to be the greatest rabbis on earth. They don't need to be rabbis at all. They just have to be basically observant, Torah observant people who are not related to either party. Not related to the party means sometimes even what you might call distantly related. It's very complicated to go through exactly the rules, so the simple way to do it is don't pick any relative to be a witness at all, because the rules of who is closely enough related is highly problematic. A good friend of mine told me he was Mesarek Kiddushin at a wedding once, and the two witnesses were called up for the Kiddushin, and he asked them, are you related to the Chassan and the Kala or each other? And they both said no. And these were rabbis with long beards and long coats and the whole thing. They said, no, we're not related to each other. And they did the whole wedding. And then right after the chuppah, someone comes over to the Masada Kiddushin, to my friend, and he said, you know, they called up one of the witnesses as a relative, as a cousin of the Kala. I don't know if you were listening to the announcements, but they called him up as a cousin of the Kala. So he said, that can't be. I asked them if they're related. That doesn't make sense. They said they're not. So just to be sure, he went over to that witness and he said, someone said that they called you up as a cousin to the Kala? He said, oh yeah. The Kala is my wife's first cousin. So he said, well, your wife's first cousin, you're not allowed to be an aide. He said, oh, I didn't know. I mean, she's not my cousin, she's my wife's cousin. He said, no, the whole wedding is invalid if the witnesses are relatives. They had to redo the Kiddushin afterwards, because the wedding, on the surface at least, the wedding was totally invalid. My friend said, you're a rabbi, how do you not know that? He said, I never learned Maseches Yevamos. He said, well, even if you had learned Maseches Yevamos, you would not know that, because that's not where the sugya is. It's a Maseches Sanhedrin, actually. But bottom line is, you have to know these things, right? You can't have a relative be a witness. On the Tanaim, it's not as big a deal, because the Tanaim doesn't really, as we said, doesn't really mean all that much nowadays. But still, whenever we call anybody a witness, we'd rather not have them sign on anything. Then the next piece of paperwork that we do is the ksuba. We sign the ksuba. The ksuba is a very important document. It is the commitment that various commitments that the husband is making to the wife, that the chassan is making to the kala. There's a discussion in the Gemara and in the Rishonim and in the Achronim whether ksuba is a din d'oraisa or it's a din d'rabbanan, whether it's something that's from the Torah or from the rabbis. But it's certainly something that we do, and it sets aside monetary amounts that he's going to be obligated to pay her if they were to ever get divorced, or if he dies before she dies, certain amounts of money that go to her. It also expresses all of the obligations that he's going to support her, and he'll make sure she has clothing and food and everything else that that he'll provide her with. It also identifies the names of the chassan and the kala and the place where the wedding is, and that's why sometimes rabbis, before they officiate at a wedding, they need to know exactly the name of the city and how do you spell that name in Hebrew, right? That was once at a wedding in Tunica, Mississippi. Tunica, Mississippi, they were once at a wedding, and we weren't sure, how do you spell Mississippi in Hebrew? And I think Rav Meir Goldwicht was a Masada Kiddushin, and I think he said he asked Rav Nata Greenblatt, and Rav Greenblatt told him that just like in English, it's M-I-S-S-S-I-S-S with all the double letters, right? So it's Mem Yud Samach Samach Yud Samach Samach Yud Pei Pei Yud, that he did it with the double letters. I'm not sure why that would be the case, but that's what he paskin. So that's all written out in the ksuba. Not only that, the financial obligation that he's committing to in the ksuba, that the chassan is committing to in the ksuba, is pretty hefty. Meaning there are three parts to the ksuba. He's committing to a basic amount that the Torah obligates him to commit to, what's called Masayim Zuz for ksuba spasula. He's also committing to extra that he wants to add in just because he loves his wife so much. So he's saying, I'm going to add in a whole bunch of extra. That's called the Tosefes Ksuba. And he's also committing that we normally, our practice is that it's Mea Zukukim Kesef. It's 100 certain type of silver German coins that he's committing himself to for the extra, which is worth, you know, depending on the price of silver, probably upwards of $10,000. And then he's also assessing whatever property she brings into the to the marriage, and saying that if anything ever happens, I'm going to reimburse you for all that. So she's got an iPad, and she's got clothing, and she's got shoes, and she's got I don't know, all sorts of different things that she's going to bring in, the boxes that she fills up from her parents' house that she moves into their apartment. So he, instead of sitting there assessing what it's actually worth and having him commit to pay that, we just assess it all at another Mea Zakukim Kesef Tsaruf, another 100 of those German coins. At the time that they instituted that, no one had that kind of money. No woman would bring in two dresses and a pair of shoes maybe, and that was it. But to make them feel rich, they would commit to much more money than it was actually worth. Nowadays, a lot of girls are bringing in a lot more than that. But anyway, that's what we write in the ksuba. The chassan should be aware of what's written in the ksuba. A lot of times they're not. The people who sign the ksuba should be aware of what's written in the ksuba. A lot of times they're not aware of what's written in the ksuba. But really you should be. Now, there are some people that are careful that they don't write the word vikanina, which says that a kinyan has been made, until the chassan actually picks up that pen or that yarmulke or whatever it may be. Because they don't want to lie, they don't want to say a kinyan has been made until a kinyan has been made. Others are not so careful about that. They'll fill in all of the words of the ksuba before the signature. Now, it's important. A lot of times, a chassan and kala will insist that they want to have the fanciest, most beautiful ksuba in the world. They want to get hire an artist, and they want it to be beautiful. Just beware that a lot of times when you have a fancy ksuba, the people who are writing it maybe aren't such great experts in the halacha of how to spell the names, of how exactly to formulate things, and it could be that the rabbi who's officiating at the wedding will take one look at the ksuba and will say, I can't use this. This ksuba is no good. And here you have a couple just spent $1,200 on a ksuba or something like that, and the rabbi is going to say, you know what? Here, I have an extra. And he'll take one that he spent $3.99 on, and that's going to be the ksuba that they end up using. So we normally recommend not to get such a fancy ksuba. We should recognize it's a financial document that outlines one's obligations, husband's obligations to his wife, but it's not a romantic document. It's a financial document, and it's something that the kala is supposed to have, and she's supposed to hold on to for the rest of her life. That's it. It's not even for the chassan to have. It's for the kala to have. The chassan doesn't need to know where it is. Let the kala have it. In fact, in some communities, the practice is that the kala gives it to her parents, and her parents guard it. It doesn't have to be with them at all times, but there is a halacha that if they lose a ksuba, they're not allowed to live together without a ksuba. So it's important that they know where their ksuba is. I once was a Masada Kiddushin at a wedding, and there was the father of the chassan was an executive vice president for the Florida Marlins, the baseball team, and he wanted to honor the general manager of the team and the owner of the team with different kibbudim. The problem is they weren't observant Jews or even Jewish at all. So what kind of kibbudim can you give them? So we came up with the idea that will the owner of the team, I think his name is Jeff Lurio, the owner of the team was called up under the chuppah after the ksuba was read, and we said his job is going to be to guard the ksuba. And that was his job. I told him, they can't go home tonight without this. So we need you to guard this carefully. So he took it very seriously. Someone tried to get it away from him to give it to the kali. He said, no, my job is to guard it. I need to know exactly where this is going. He was very, very careful about that. And that's fine. Now, at the chassan sish, I forgot to mention, after they signed the tanaim, they then read the tanaim. Just to make sure that it says everything that it's supposed to say. And then the mothers of the chassan and kala typically will break a plate at the end of the reading of the Tanaim. Why do they break a plate? A lot of different explanations of why they have that minhag. It's a minhag, an old minhag. Some say it's to remember the Churban of Yerushalayim. You shouldn't get carried away with your joy and forget Yerushalayim, so you break something valuable. Others say it's to remember just not to get carried away with your joy and make poor decisions by being too lightheaded. Others say that no, it's showing that the agreement in the Tanaim is binding, just like a broken plate cannot be put back together. This agreement, once it's done, is done, and there's no breaking off of this of this agreement to get married. Okay, so that's the Tanaim and the Ksuba. Then they go to what's called Badekin. Badekin is when the chassan takes the veil and puts it over the kala's face. Some Rishonim hold that Badekin is actually something that affects marriage. It makes them married. And as consequently, the chassan should do it himself. A lot of times. The chassan will go up to the kala to put the veil over her face, and the mother of the chassan and the mother of the kala do not trust the chassan to know how to take a veil and go like that with it. So they're going to start helping, and they're going to do... That's the time for the mothers to step away, or just to keep their arms down and let the chassan himself put the veil over her face, because he's the one that has to perform the wedding. Why do we put the veil over the face? It probably has roots in the Chumash itself. This week's parsha, Rivka meets Yitzchak, and the pasuk says she took a veil and she covered herself up. That it's a symbol of a demonstration of modesty. Others say that no, she puts the veil over. They put the veil over her face so she won't see the wedding ring. You don't want her to see the wedding ring, because if she sees the wedding ring, we're suspicious that people might think that she's only marrying him because he's giving such a nice ring. So if she can't see it anyway, then we know she's fully committed to him. It's not just the nice jewelry that he's giving her. Okay, then we're ready for the chuppah, which I probably should have started talking about 20 minutes ago already. So let's get to the chuppah itself. So the chassan and kala get ready for the chuppah. There is a practice to get married outdoors or under the sky, to have a window that opens up to the sky. That is a minhag. It's an old minhag. It's quoted in Shulchan Aruch. It's considered a siman bracha to get married underneath the stars, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Avraham Avinu, your children are going to be like the stars. So we want to do something that will demonstrate the continuity of the Jewish people. So under the stars is a sign of bracha. If it's not possible, you're getting married at an indoor venue and it's cold outside, it's the middle of a Chicago winter or something, so it's not really so practical to get married outdoors. Some wedding halls will have like a window that opens up overhead. Others don't, and it's not the end of the world. I remember when I got married, there was a window that opened up, but it was like off to the side of the room a little bit. Like it wasn't centered. So I asked Rav Schechter, like, you know, do we have to build the chuppah there, totally off to the side? And he said, look, you don't have to get married under a window. But if there's a window in the room anyway, then you might as well set up the chuppah where the window is. So that's what we did. Our chuppah was like totally off to the side. I remember looking up, I only saw women. We were all on the whole chuppah was on the women's side of the room. The men's side of the room, men were looking at nothing, and the women were looking at the chuppah. It was an unusual setup. But that's what Rav Schechter told us to do, so that's what we did. Typically, the practice is that the parents of the chassan and the parents of the kala walk them down to the chuppah. It is not required that a dafka be the parents, but that's the common practice. In some communities, the fathers of both walk the chassan down, and the mothers walk the kala down. Certainly, if someone doesn't have a mother or a father, someone else will take their place, or just one parent will walk the child down to the chuppah. But there is an idea of having what's called shushvinin, having people accompany the chassan and kala to the chuppah. That's probably where the whole idea of having other people walk down the aisle came from. Really, the walking down the aisle used to be that it was just a group of people that would accompany the chassan and the kala to the chuppah. So nowadays, people split it up a little bit, and they have like whoever else, other family members. Some people have friends walk down. Some people have rabbis walk down in certain communities. That's symbolic of the shushvinin. You may notice at some weddings, the father of the chassan and mother of the chassan, father of the kala and mother of the kala, carry candles as they're walking down. That's an old minhag also, probably relates to Har Sinai. That just like Har Sinai, there was lightning, so we have these little bolts of lightning called candles that we use as we walk down to the wedding. That's how some of the Rishonim explain that practice. You'll notice at many weddings when the chassan and kala walk down, everyone stands up. Where that comes from is not abundantly clear. It used to be probably that they didn't have chairs at weddings, so probably everyone was standing anyway. But it could be that it's based on the respect that we try to give to a chassan and kala, or it could just be that the Mishnah tells us in the third parak of Maseches Bikurim that when someone is going to do a mitzvah, that you're supposed to honor people who are going to do a mitzvah. So chassan and kala are going to potentially do a mitzvah. Again, you learned about that, whether yes or no. So maybe we stand up for those who are going to do a mitzvah. One thing is for sure, though, there's a pasuk in the Torah, Mipnei Seva Takum Vahadarta Pnei Zaken, that when a Talmud Chacham or an older person walks by, you're supposed to stand up. So very often the grandparents, and now even sometimes I've been at weddings where the great grandparents of the Chassan and Kala, Baruch Hashem, imagine such a thing, are still alive and are walking down the aisle. Now, when people who are of an advanced age walk down the aisle, it's certainly a mitzvah d'oraisa to stand up, even more important than standing up for the chassan and the kala. It is customary for the chassan to wear kittel. There are different opinions as to why that's the case, but this is quoted in Rishonim. It could relate to the Yom Kippur element of it, that white clothing represents mechilas avonos, that one is pristine, just like the kala is wearing all white, the chassan wears all white as well. There is a practice quoted in the Gemara already that the chassan should have ashes on the makom tefillin, right where he puts his tefillin. They put ashes on his head, and that's to remember the korban. That's why, by the way, at the end of the chuppah, they often will sing Im Eshkachech Yerushalayim. It's not just stam to sing a song. Im Eshkachech Yerushalayim is because at the height of the simcha, right when they're about to really celebrate, they're about to really get carried away with celebration, they put ashes on the head, and the Gemara says, why do we put ashes on the head? Because Im Eshkachech Yerushalayim Tishkach Imini Tidbak Lishoni Lechiki. I mean, the Gemara quotes that pasuk as the reason that we put ashes on the head. I was once at a wedding, and they started singing Im Eshkachech, and I heard two guys behind me talking, and one of them said to the other, what are they doing? Why are they singing this? And the other one said, it's a YU thing. It's a YU practice. So I turned around and I said, no, I think it's a Gemara. I don't think it's a YU practice. I think the Gemara, I just couldn't contain myself. But, you know, when people trash YU, I feel like I need to defend us. But it's a Gemara. It's an explicit Gemara. Not that you have to sing it, but that it certainly is not inappropriate to sing it. There's also a practice, you may have noticed, that the kallahs remove their jewelry. If a chassan has jewelry, he should remove his jewelry also before the chuppah. And this probably also relates to the idea, the Rama writes, by Badekin, similar idea, that we don't want people to think that they're marrying each other for their money. So you take away all the fancy jewelry, and everything is just simple, and there's no tricks about what they're marrying each other for. They're marrying each other because they love each other, they want to spend the rest of their lives with each other. It's not about the money. So they remove their jewelry. There is a more recent practice that a lot of times the kala will take off her jewelry and give a piece of jewelry to each of her friends to watch during the wedding. There's no basis whatsoever for that practice, and I would recommend against it unless you have a very clear list of who has what. Because I've been asked the shaila more than once, where when they collected her jewelry afterwards, she didn't get everything back. So that's probably not a great idea, to just go taking expensive jewelry and passing it around the room and assuming that you'll get everything back. So, to just not have the jewelry, that is a legitimate practice. Once the kala walks down the chuppah, walks down the aisle, the chassan goes first. So then, say he's there, the kala walks down, and she walks around him seven times. She walks around the chassan seven times. By Svardim, some Svardim don't do that at all. Some Svardim will only walk around three times. Typically, it's a good idea to have someone keeping count. Whatever that represents, it's probably based on the Gemara, but the idea, the kala walks around seven times. Once the kala walks around seven times, she stops on the right side of the chassan. The kala should stand to the right of the chassan, and now we're ready to start the actual marriage. Right now we're ready to make a wedding. So how do you make a wedding? So they call up a Mesader Kiddushin. The Mesader Kiddushin is just the guy that's there, the rabbi that's there, to make sure that everything runs properly and that everything is done appropriately. He also is the one typically who says the bracha on the kos for the Kiddushin. So the Masada Kiddushin takes the kos in his hand, often even before saying the bracha, he'll ask the chassan, do you have the ring? And the chassan will say yes, and he'll say, did you pay for the ring with your own money? It has to belong to him. And he'll say, yes, I paid for the ring with my own money. I just got a call about a month ago, a guy was getting married 2 days later, he said that he lost the ring, and he's getting married tomorrow. What should he do? So I said, go buy another one. He said, I don't have any money. So I said, what do you mean you don't have any money? He said, all of our money is in a joint bank account. My money is already her money. So I don't have any money of my own. I said, ask your dad for money. He said, I did, and he paid for the first ring, and he'll kill me and tell me I'm not ready to get married if I tell him that I lost the ring. I said, I'll send my son over with $150 and you can go buy a new ring. He's like, no, I'm not going to take money from you. Okay, well, I don't know what they did in the end, but the chassan has to have paid for the ring with his own money. They'll ask the witnesses. They're going to call up two witnesses. Now, these two witnesses, other than the chassan and kala, are the most important people at the wedding, because a couple cannot be married without two kosher witnesses. So they'll ask the witnesses in front of the chassan and kala, primarily in front of the kala, is this ring, does this ring look like it's worth a pruta? It has to be worth at least a pruta. A pruta is a tiny amount of money. It is a very, very small amount of money. The ring is worth way more than a pruta. But they ask that so that the kala not think that it's some super fancy ring. Again, we want to avoid any suspicion that she's only getting married because she's getting this fancy jewelry. No, you're getting married because you love him anyway. You're getting married regardless of this. So we say, is it worth a pruta? And they say, yeah, it's worth a pruta. And she's happy with that too. So that's what we do. Then the chassan hangs on to the ring. The Masada Kiddushin recites a bracha, Baruch Pri Hagafen, and then the Birchas Erisin, which you learned about, I assume, a little bit, the bracha on the Kiddushin, Sha'asu lanos harayos, v'hitir lanos hanesuos lanu alidei chuppah v'kiddushin. He recites the Birchas Erisin. He gives a sip of wine to the chassan, a sip of wine to the kala. The general practice is that the Masada Kiddushin doesn't give the sip directly to the chassan and kala. The mother of the chassan will give to the chassan, the mother of the kala will give to the kala, or maybe the fathers will get involved. Usually someone will give them. They don't take the kos in their hands themselves for some reason. They have someone else serve it to them. And just a little sip, and then the chassan and kala face each other. The Masada Kiddushin will tell the kala, stick out your right index finger. If she's a righty, if she's a lefty, then her left index finger. And the chassan will take the ring. He'll say, "Hare at mekudeshes li b'taba zo kedas Moshe v'Yisrael." And hopefully there will be a card there that he'll be able to read it from, because normally he's too nervous to remember his line. And then right after he says those words, he puts the ring on the kala's finger. And now she takes the ring, mekudeshes. Now they are half married. They have what's called kiddushin. She is now no longer, she's now considered a married woman as far as the whole rest of the world is concerned. But as far as her husband is concerned, they're not yet allowed to go home together because they're only half married. They have kiddushin at that point. So the next thing they want to do is nisuin. You do that through seven brachos that are recited under the chuppah. But the first of those brachos is Baruch Pri Hagafen, and you just said a Baruch Pri Hagafen. So it doesn't make sense to say two Baruch Pri Hagafens, right, one right after the other. So what we do is we stall for time. How do we stall for time? We call someone up to read the ksuba. Just to kill time. There's no real reason that the ksuba needs to be read at that time. Someone comes up and he reads the ksuba. So the person reads the ksuba. He should read it nice and slowly, so to stall for time a little bit. And then the chassan gives the ksuba to the kala, and the kala hangs on to it. Or you can give it to Jeff Luria to hang on to, you know, whoever the kala chooses to watch over it for her. And that's her ksuba to have. And now we're ready for the nisuin. So the nisuin is they start calling up different people to recite seven brachos. Usually it's not the Masada Kiddushin. By Sfardim, many Sfardim at least, the Masada Kiddushin does recite all seven brachos himself. But in most Ashkenazi weddings, certainly, they call up different people, rabbis, relatives. The people reciting the brachos can be relatives. That's not a problem. They are allowed to be related to the chassan, the kala. It could be the grandparents or the father or whatever. And they recite the different brachos. Sometimes they'll combine the first two two brachos. The same person will say the first two brachos. And the reason they do that is because the first bracha is just a Baruch Pi HaGafen, and some people feel that it's not so much of an honor just to recite Baruch Pi HaGafen. So they want to honor the person, so they want him to be able to say a bracha he doesn't always get to say all the time. So they'll give the first two brachos to the same person. Other times they'll split it up into among other people. In Europe, it used to be that one rabbi would say all seven brachos. When the Satmar Rebbe, Rav Shachter used to tell us, when the Satmar Rebbe noticed in America, they called up different people for every bracha. He was stunned. He had never seen that before. He said, pretty soon, they're going to call up two different people, one to say bu and the other to say rich, because the way the Hasidic pronunciation is burichatu. So one to say bu, the other to say rich. I mean, he thought that they were breaking it down too much. Okay, so then they say the seven brachos, and now the couple is, almost according to everybody, the couple is married. They then put the ashes, or sometimes they'll put the ashes before, but most commonly they'll put the ashes on the head of the chassan. They'll sing Im Eshkachech. The chassan will break a glass. The breaking of the glass also to symbolize that let's not get too carried away. Let's remember that there used to be a Beis HaMikdash, and we hope to have a Beis HaMikdash again. And right now we don't have one, and therefore we're not fully elated as much as we should be because we don't have a Beis HaMikdash. That's what the breaking of the glass represents, even though most often wrapped in that napkin is just like a cheap light bulb or something. But still, it represents the idea that... because they try not to take an expensive glass, because sometimes they're really well constructed and the chassan like break his foot trying to break the glass, so they take like a cheap light bulb and they wrap it in that. But he just breaks the glass, and then the practice is the chassan takes the kala by the hand, kala takes the chassan by the hand. Even among very, very frum people, they hold each other's hands as they leave the chuppah, and they go to what's called the cheder yichud, the yichud room, because according to some, they're not fully married until they have yichud together. Yichud means that they're all alone in a room, the door is locked behind them, there are two witnesses that stand outside the room to make sure nobody gets in, that nobody else goes into the room, and that they spend several minutes together, however many, some say 5, some say 8 or 9 minutes, however many minutes together, alone, and now they are really, 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 really fully married, once they have that yichud. By Sfardim, they don't do yichud at the wedding. They go home together later that night, but they don't do yichud together at the wedding. And there are other circumstances where maybe yichud can't be done at the wedding, but we're not going to get into that right now, since I think I'm already over time. So maybe should we open up to questions?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Now that
it's because you have multiple devices, I think, on.
Hold on 1 second. I think that's better. 1 second.
I think you... Okay.
Is that better?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you have only one device.
And I'm gonna turn my screen around.
Okay.
First of all, thank you so much, Rebbe. That's amazing. He's right here. Don't worry.
Hi, okay. Everyone.
I just wanna know. I was actually thinking this morning. First of all, thank you so much for that. That was amazing. I hope we all got so much out of that. I was thinking as I was starting Shnei Mikra, this week's parsha, Rebbe, like, was mentioned is Chai Yisorah. I think about 8 years ago, maybe 9, after Camp Keli, I spent a Shabbos at the Leibowitz's, and I think it was Parsha's Chai Yisorah. Because Friday night dinner, Rabbi Leibowitz told us an idea, the Dvar Torah, based on this week's parsha. It's actually based in our Gemara in Kiddushin about Kicha Kicha Mistei Afron. I think Rabbi quoted the Bava Varevi, his favorite Sheva Baruchas idea. And just like Ephron and Avram both thought they got the best idea, so too the Chassan and Kala both think that they just got the best deal in the entire world by getting the other one. We'll talk more about that on Friday. But either way, I still remember, I think about that every Chai Sar and really every Shabbat.
Good part. So good part to have.
I think it was about 8, 9 years ago. We're going to open it up for questions. As I mentioned, Rabbi Leibowitz gives dozens and dozens of shirim. One thing he does, I think it's about every Thursday night, I don't know if it's still that, NYU, he gives something called From Behind the Rabbi's Desk. People email him and call him, text him, WhatsApp him, shilas from all over the world, really. And if anybody, feel free. There's nothing that is too far out. I'm sure if you think you have the weirdest shy in the world, I promise you, he's had weirder ones. But feel free to ask anything, and we'll do a few minutes of question and answer now. So anybody want to jump in, and we can move the screen as we see fit. Anybody? Don't be shy.
Yeah.
A school,
School,
yeah. Yeah, I think that's more of a modern skula. I don't think
Oh, hold
that's
on.
a. Oh, you don't hear me? Are you
Yeah,
able?
now go for it.
Are you able to hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's more of a modern skula. I'm not really sure what it's based on. I don't know. I think a better skula would be to that the Kala should give brachos to all of her friends who want to get married, that they should be fortunate enough to get married. I think it's based on the idea that they're trying to sort of like get a little bit of of the Kala's luck or whatever, but I don't know if that's really based on anything real. I think I once gave a shiur about it online. But yeah.
Is the bedekin a minhag or is it like a halacha?
I'm sorry, I didn't
Is
hear.
bedekin a minhag or a halacha?
Oh, so bedekin, it may be a very serious halacha, or it may just be a minhag, meaning it's a big machlokas exactly what it accomplishes. Some people take it so seriously that they'll appoint witnesses for the bedekin. So we try to take it somewhat seriously, at least that the chassan should do it himself and not have any help in doing it. It's certainly something that we do. Even if it's a minhag, it's based on the chumash, so it's like a really, really old minhag.
Anybody?
How come, you know how we also mentioned this in class, but I don't think we got an answer of like how come we don't like a year before do the
Right, we do Kiddushin, right? So we still have Kiddushin and Yisuin are usually far apart, and nowadays we kind of just clump them together.
Yeah, I think just socially it wouldn't work out nowadays. People to have a year where you know who you're going to marry and still not get married and have those commitments that if you break them have very serious consequences. It's too many broken engagements. Imagine if every engaged couple had this like serious cherem and like sort of curses on them for breaking it. You wouldn't want that. You wouldn't want that in people's heads. So we just wait till everything's already settled and then we just do it then. If they're not fully married, they should not. No, that's the one of the ways of signifying that they are married is that they're allowed to have yichud together, that they're allowed to be alone together. If they're not yet married, then they're not allowed to have yichud together. They're not allowed to be alone together. That's the isser. It goes from being an isser to being something that's entirely appropriate. Not only that, even after they're married, there are times where the chasan and kala, even after marriage, are not allowed to be physical with each other. But yichud is always okay. They're always allowed to have yichud with each other, even if they can't be intimate with each other.
Anything else? Hannah, did you want to ask that question? Email me or no? You want to?
I don't know if they really hear me. But so basically, should I give the context?
Yeah. Hey, Rabbi, can you hear?
So far.
Okay.
You can hear?
Yeah.
Okay. So I have this friend who I recently made, and she used to be Jewish, I guess. I don't know what branch of Judaism, but she used to be Jewish. And then.
Well, hold on. Listen.
And then she converted to Christianity because, in her words, her family found the Messiah. So then, I mean, I guess I was just talking to her because we're just friends. We talked about not really, but about, religions, about nothingness. And then I was looking at her Instagram and like looking through her captions and pictures. And one of her pictures was from when she went to Israel a few years ago. And she talked about in the caption about this pastor, I don't remember his name, McShane maybe. He's a Scottish pastor, and he would go to Israel to try to convert Jews to Christianity so that they could see Jesus as their Messiah. And she said that she also believes this, that one day the veil that is on the Jews' eyes will be taken off, and they'll see Jesus as their savior, and they'll be saved and redeemed. So my question was, can I continue to talk to her if I know that this is her kind of maybe life's mission?
That's difficult. That's very difficult.
It's a lot.
You know, missionizing is definitely a major, you know, there are a lot of people, there are a lot of missionaries out there. There are a lot of people that that's really their goal. One of the major reasons that that the big supporters of Israel are very religious Christians in this country is because they believe in order for Jesus to come back, you got to bring all the Jews to Israel, and then they'll either have the opportunity to accept him or to all die. It's a real, real issue. On the other hand, if she is in fact a Jew, if her mother is a Jew, which I don't know if you know that for sure, that her mother is an actual halachic Jew, then you have a mitzvah to do kiruv and to try to educate her on what it means to be a Jew and all the beauty of Torah and mitzvos. You probably have to do a real assessment of who's more likely to influence who. You know, if you're uncomfortable trying to be makarif her, or if your acts of kiruv will be met with something in the other direction, that she'll be pushing back in the other direction, it seems a little bit dangerous. You know, she may raise questions that you're not yet fully equipped to deal with, even though there are obviously answers to all those questions, but you want to make sure that you have a really strong knowledge of your own religion before you're able to debate anybody about it, before you're able to confront those challenges. So I'm a little more cautious by nature. I'm sure there are others that would tell you otherwise. I would say to try to stay away from any conversation about religion, from any theological conversation. I don't think you have to not be friends with her. You can, she can see what a beautiful life religious Jews live. But if it gets to any conversation about religion, I would say that this makes me a little uncomfortable, and I'd prefer not to talk about this.
Some more questions?
Sure.
Okay, so this is also kind of random, but over Shabbos, my brother wanted to rake leaves, and my mom was like, "Oh, like I don't think you can do that." And then like we were trying to figure out why. Like, why can't, and then my dad's like, well, maybe you can do it, like, on the street. Like, maybe you can do it on the street. Grass.
He didn't care where he was raking leaves. As long as he's raking leaves, he was going to be happy?
Well, first he wanted to on the grass because he wanted to do it on the grass first. But then, like, someone in my family was like, oh, I think, like, you can do it on the street because, like, if the reason why you can't is because it's ripping up grass, then, like, you should be fine doing it on the street.
Okay, so there are a couple of issues with raking leaves. So certainly, as you said, on the grass, it's a problem because you're going to uproot the leaves, so that's going to be a problem. You can uproot the grass, and that's you're not allowed to do on Shabbos. There's also a malacha called ma'amer. The malacha of ma'amer means to gather something together. Gathering or bundling, they used to do it with wheat, you know, that they would gather together wheat. If you have produce, let's say, you're not allowed to gather it together and make a big pile of it. But ma'amer is if you're doing it for some useful purpose. If you're collecting something only to throw it out, then you probably have not violated the malacha of ma'amer mida oraisa. So that's what you're doing with leaves. You're trying to throw them out. So on a d'oraisa level, you have not violated ma'amer. However, if I'm not mistaken, it's still a violation of ma'amer midrabanan, even if you're going to throw it out. So I would say that even on the street, best not to rake the leaves.
That's all you have on the word. The answer? You have a question? Okay. Thank you so much, Rabbi.
My pleasure. Okay. Hatzlacha Rabbah, everyone. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.